case before the court, case number 13-1625. Mr. Lee, are you going to go first, or is Mr. Newton going to go first?
Your Honor, I'm going to go first, and what I've done is reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, which I will address the patent damages and FRAND issues. We'd like to reserve 5 minutes. I'm going to try to save 2 minutes of my time for Mr. Newton, but we've agreed that if time is short and we're addressing something, we may hit a point where we'll just submit. He and I will both submit on the briefs on the license issue.
Okay.
Okay, but when I get to close to the 2 or 3 minute mark left, I may shoot it to Mr. Newton if I could.
Okay.
May it please the Court, my name is Bill Lee, and together with my partner, Lauren Fletcher, we represent the appellants and defendants below. As I said, I will address the patent damages and RAND issues before the Court. Although the jury awarded only approximately $10 million in damages, this case actually has implications that are much broader. I think the substantial participation of the amici demonstrates that, and there are really three reasons before I move to the substance of the patents for this.
Would you mind, I mean, just at least speaking for myself, I appreciate that this is important, so and time is limited and there are a lot of issues. On the 215 patent, suppose that we agreed with you that the selected to minimize language had to be included in the claim construction. Do we know whether there is non-infringement under that revised claim construction, or is that a matter that would have to be tried because the claim construction all changed?
We know the answer to that question. And, Your Honor, I think I'm hoping that in my argument time this morning for each of the three patents, I can demonstrate to you that there is one claim limitation and one absolutely undisputed fact. And that that combination, the claim limitation and the undisputed fact, require determination non-infringement. On the 215, the claim limitation is the one that I think Your Honor is talking about, but there are three parts to the claim limitation. It is responsive to the receiving step, constructing a message, including a type identifier field. There are three important portions of this. One is there is a time and an event that must occur before the message is constructed. That's the responsive. The second is the constructing of a message at that point in time and after the receipt. And the third is, what are you constructing? And that's the reason for the claim construction dispute. Now, the undisputed fact would lead to non-infringement under either claim interpretation, because here's the undisputed fact. The patent says we are distinguishing a static one-size-fits-all response. That's in the patent.
Right, I guess I'm trying to understand this. I took it that you had two essential points, the claim construction point about the constructing has to be done for the purpose of minimization, and then you have a point about how, regardless of whether minimization has to be the basis for the constructing, the receiver actually has to have a choice. Suppose we didn't agree about the choice part, okay? Because the choice part is enough if we agreed with it for you to win without regard to the minimizing, right? Because
correct.
The receiver does not
correct.
Make a choice. It has a program that made the choice
correct.
To create what the receiver can do. So what I'm trying to understand is on the claim construction issue, the choice part's not a claim construction issue, but on the claim construction issue, or it's a construction of the construction issue, but it's not the minimizing point. How do we know, or what's the answer to the question I guess I asked you? If the receiver doesn't have to make a choice, but there is a requirement that the construction, which may be uniform, across the board, always the same, B for minimizing. What does that mean for whether there is infringement or not?
It means, Your Honor, if I take it, I think I may have paused because our proposed construction, I think your use of the word choice, I think we use the word selecting, but if we call selecting and minimizing as the two aspects of our claim construction. So let me answer it this way. There is the district court's claim construction, which we say should have incorporated the ideas of selecting and minimizing.
If we focus on minimizing,
we don't do that. We have a static, one-size-fits-all response. It's the block acknowledgement. And there's a reason for that. The specification makes it very clear that the reason for having the overhead, because to make the minimization decision, you have to decide, should I use a bitmap, should I use a list? There's overhead. The specification says, we're doing that because we're going to save bandwidth. But 802.11 doesn't need that, so it doesn't minimize.
Is the language about minimizing, was that actually language that purposely distinguishes prior art?
Yes.
How so?
Because, Your Honor, this goes back to my block.
You're saying the prior
point.
Art didn't try to minimize?
The prior art actually had static responses, and if the court considers column 3, line 56 to 50, column 3, line 46 to 50 of the patent, it's at A278. The purpose of the invention is described to avoid a static use of a one-size-fits-all acknowledgement. And the whole purpose of the 215 patent is this. If you have a one-size-fits-all acknowledgement, you may be using more bandwidth than is required. So what they do is there's a trade-off. We'll have more overhead, but we'll end up using less bandwidth. 802.11n, and the record demonstrates this, doesn't have that bandwidth problem. So it has a static block acknowledgement. So we have exactly what is distinguished in the patent itself as a prior art. This is an analogy that at least helped me understand it. This is a circumstance where...
Can I ask you this? Doesn't the protocol that... I understand that it uses one specific way of sending that at least the type identifier field is one specific way of doing it. But isn't that itself a way to minimize feedback response in a protocol? You've chosen... There are four or five different options, I guess, in the table. And it could be that they... on a device may pick from those, like your construction B. But why isn't, if the device pre-chooses from them, it's still minimizing feedback?
Your Honor, there are two answers to that question. The device isn't choosing at all. That's why, when I was answering Judge Toronto's question, putting the type identifier field in the context of responsive to the receiving step in constructing, that's why that is so important, because the receiver is not doing anything.
No, I understand you think your receiver does that, and that the patent requires receivers that do, right?
You have to make a choice in order to minimize. And this, Your Honor, if I could, this is the analogy that I would give you. If you invented the car, and the car had one speed, had one gear, and then someone came up and said, well, I have a new car. It has four speeds. One, drive one, drive two, drive three, drive four. And I'm distinguishing that because the prior art only had one speed, drive one. So what I'm saying is, what the invention is when you're in the car, you can judge the circumstances, and the driver, the receiver, can make a choice. Drive one, drive two, drive three, drive four.
Okay,
that's better.
You're getting a little far afield here. All right. So was there a type identifier field in the prior art?
Yes.
Forget about the car.
Yes.
Let's talk about
the
type. So there was a type identifier field in the prior art.
It's a static one. The acknowledgement was the static one-size-fits-all, which is at A278. And we have a static one-size-fits-all. Now, to go to Judge Hughes' question, it is for sure chosen in the design of the product, which is why I think, I didn't use the car analogy to get far afield, but I think it...
And this is where I'm struggling, because I think for you to prevail, we have to adopt your claim construction on reading the limitation from the preamble about minimizing and your interpretation of that in, because otherwise the responsive and constructing and things like that, that seems to me that your devices all do that. It gets data in, which is responsive to the receiving stuff. It constructs a message field to send back, which includes a number field, a link field, a contact field, and a type identifier field. Your type identifier field is always static, but the other stuff may not be. In fact, I'm sure the content field isn't static because it's sending a message back about the errors in the data it received. So why isn't that responsive to the receiving step and then on down the line fulfilling all those limitations?
Your Honor, because if you interpret the claim as you just described it, respectfully, you cover what they described as a prior art. That would cover that static one-size-fits-all acknowledgement, because if I take Your Honor's analogy, there's a receiving step in your analogy. There's a message constructed, and it's a one-size-fits-all. You have just decided that the claim covers precisely what's described in the prior art. And I think that's the important point. You have to take the patentee at their word. They distinguish a one-size-fits-all response. We have a one-size-fits-all response because we don't need to make the minimization decision. So whether you focus on the selecting portion of what we propose, you focus on the minimization portion, and you can adopt one or the two and it leads to the same result. Or, frankly, if you use the district court's claim interpretation but take the patent at its word, this is the one fact that I don't think there's any dispute about. We have a one-size-fits-all static response.
Can I shift gears here
sure.
for a minute? 625, Petrus anticipation. If we decide that there is non-infringement, do we have to reach anticipation? I gather at least some of the defendants here filed counterclaims for invalidity judgments and I guess got them.
They got judgments that the patent was not invalid based upon.
Right.
Right.
So
right.
So do we need to reach the anticipation question if we decide there is no infringement of 625?
I think, Your Honor, there's both the practical and theoretical. It's a practical matter, I don't think you do.
Practical matter, it's because you argue that your infringement argument and the anticipation argument are two sides of one coin. It's either one or the other. Isn't that right?
I think you're right. Yes, I think on the invalidity side, to make it clear. On the non-infringement side, we surely argue that the claim requires the transmitter to command a receiver to receive an out-of-sequence packet. And again, one fact, which is the 802.11 receivers receive all packets. In sequence, out of sequence. There's no command. Dr. Nettles agreed with that.
Right, but I mean, your argument is that if we agree with you on the 625 as it relates to infringement, then the same argument is made with respect to Petrus, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but this is a slight difference. 802.11 is different because we don't have the deadlock problem. Since we receive all out-of-sequence or in-sequence packets, there's never a deadlock. Petrus does describe the deadlock problem that's addressed in the 625 patent and has a discard message attached to the next packet, packet 5 in the example in Petrus, that says discard the old one. So Petrus is different than us in the sense that there's a deadlock problem, but it deals with it precisely as the
patent. Right, but not materially different from what you say you are for
correct.
Purposes of
correct.
The anticipation
correct.
Analysis.
Yeah, and I think in the interest of time, what I would say, again, trying to put these one limitation, one fact.
Frank, I was asking you to tell me, do you stand here today and say, on behalf of your clients, that if the judgment of infringement is reversed, that we need not reach the question of anticipation?
No, because there are some of the JDG group who have filed a declaratory judgment of invalidity, and because the patent could be asserted in a later context against a different product, that would need to be decided.
There's a lot to talk about, but I want to switch to the damages discussion a little
sure.
bit before, because you've
sure.
only got 5 minutes left before you're going to be into your rebuttal. And that's still saving his 2 minutes, don't worry. But so let me ask you some questions. I've got, it seems like there were some at least odd choices here that were made at trial. I mean, the defendants chose to go to the jury on the RAND issue, correct? I mean, the judge offered to do a RAND analysis, and you all refused to have him do that in any way that would be binding.
I think there are two parts, Your Honor. There is the latter part where the defendants talked about what the judge should do in the jury waive portion, but the question of the hypothetical negotiation was going to the jury one way or another. And what we said was, if it's going to go, it needs to go with a set of instructions that puts this in the RAND context. And I would just make these points.
But
I'm sorry.
You're still, I understand you've got an argument that there's some jury instructions that we're missing, but my point is, the judge offered to have a trial in which the judge would either determine a range or determine a rate. And you all said, no, we won't be bound by any determination that the judge makes. Is that right?
That's correct on the jury waive portion.
Okay. So I do not understand your argument that you put all this other evidence in front of the judge and that somehow that meant that the record before the jury wasn't adequate. I mean, if you had evidence on the RAND issues, you should have put it in front of the jury if you were the ones who chose to make the issue go to the jury.
Your Honor, I don't think we've made that argument. If we did, that was our miscommunication. We did not make that argument. Our argument was the following on RAND, and it doesn't rely upon any of the evidence that went in during the two-hour jury waive portion. It relies upon the request for instructions, basically building on the Innovatio decision by Judge Holderman and the Microsoft decision by Judge Robarts, said the following three things. One is, Georgia-Pacific, which is now almost as old as I am, isn't sufficient to deal maybe with a broad set of patent cases, but you don't need to reach that issue. It's certainly not sufficient to deal with RAND issues. And Judge Holderman and Judge Robarts, you know, what we think
of... I'm sorry to interrupt. Can I just ask you about this? You asked for not only a RAND-specific instruction, but in fact for clarification with respect to standardization value of other pieces, paragraph 9 or item 9, and
right,
whatever it is of Georgia-Pacific. Here's my question. Why isn't it wholly without respect to whether a member of a standard-setting organization made a RAND commitment a necessary aspect of calculating a reasonable royalty to exclude the value that came from adoption of the technology as standard?
It should be, and that's what we asked for.
Right, but that point is not specifically dependent on RAND. RAND is whatever else it is. It's a contract. Whatever its interpretation might mean, it might be, is a matter of what the people entering into the contract by joining the SSO meant by it. But we have a statutory question about royalties under 284, which might well have a different standard, might in fact have a somewhat more demanding standard. A RAND might in fact take account of standardization enhancement for everything. So why is this dependent on RAND?
If I were to take the holdup and the stacking issue, you might have different answers. But the holdup issue or the value after standardization for sure isn't necessarily dependent on the party having made a RAND commitment. But the fact that the party did make a RAND commitment is part of the analysis. And Judge Holderman in his...
But the judge instructed the jury that they did make a RAND commitment. In fact, Judge Holderman, in his own opinion, says the jury was properly instructed in your case, and so that was all factored in.
Now, Your Honor, I think I'd say two things to that. If Your Honor considers the two instructions that are A221 and A226, and you compare them to actually what Judge Holderman instructed and to for both Judge Holderman and Judge Robarts, the additions and deletions to Georgia-Pacific,
yeah,
they are
first
radically
of all,
different.
Those were bench trials, number one. There was never any statement in either of those cases that these are required jury instructions. And certainly we have never said that they are required jury instructions. So, I mean, we have to remember the context that we're talking about.
Your Honor, there was...
They did, unlike you, agree to let the judge make the determination so the judge could do the analysis the judge felt appropriate.
Your Honor, let me ask Mr. Newton if he'll see his... So I'm into my rebuttal, our rebuttal time. Let me answer the question and just make one more point, and then I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. There actually was for Judge Robards, there was a jury trial afterwards.
Right.
And
the
jury,
to determine the breach of contract, correct?
But it was to determine whether there was a breach of contract given a royalty range, and he instructs the jury on the meaning of RAND and the importance of RAND, having done the modification to the...
Right. Again, they opted for a different approach, though, than you did.
Now, Your Honor, I think saying that we opted for a different approach, we're the defendant. They put in the damage claim. The damage claim had a hypothetical negotiation as part of it. We said if that's going to go to the jury, then there should be instructions both on the value of the patented feature technically and economically as opposed to the standardization value and stacking. We got neither of those, and if you compare it to Judge Robart's articulation of Georgia-Pacific factors, it is just night and day. Let me just make this last point.
Wait, before you sit down, I do have a couple questions, and there's a lot more on this that I have questions on, but I do need to ask you a question on this EMVR, because there was something in your briefs that really troubled me, is that you repeatedly refer to counsel's statements about the cost of laptops. And when they call you on it and say you never objected, you come back and say, oh, yeah, we had a continuing objection to that. But you didn't, because that continuing objection was only to references to those other licenses, not to counsel's statements. There was never a single objection to those statements, and yet you tried to say there was.
No, Your Honor, I think, let me say two things. We had a Daubert motion.
I understand that. The Daubert motion related to the licenses, his ability to reference the licenses. The loose statements that counsel made, which you pointed to in voir dire and other places and arguments, you never objected to. And then you actually asked a witness and referred to the price of laptops. So, I mean...
Your Honor, I actually think if you go back and look at the Daubert motion, it was...
I did.
It was entire market value. That was the issue.
Well, the point was the expert was not allowed to rely on those licenses because that put them into the entire market value analysis.
Right. And that was denied.
Right. That does not cover your ability to your objections to statements of counsel.
Well, Your Honor, let me just say this. I say by rebuttal time, if you bring a Daubert motion, and there are many now after Lucent Unilock, and you object on the basis of the entire market value, and the district holds the entire market value is not implicated, and that the total revenues can go in, if we're going to object every time it comes up, it's going to be a problem. This is a case where there was a Daubert motion.
These are apples and oranges, and so I think that your brief was actually not accurate. But putting that aside, go ahead.
Did you make an exhaustion argument, namely that Ericsson granted Intel an implied license for free to make and sell these units, and therefore its customers were under no patent restriction from Ericsson? Why not? Tell me what's wrong with that.
Because they didn't seek damages against us? Is that the question, Your Honor?
Well, in thinking about what you've referred to as entire market value, namely the broad contention that the identification of a proper royalty cannot take into account enhancement of the value of the end user product, which I'm not sure how that could possibly be true. A lot of this seems to have to do with what price Intel was able to sell the chips at, which seems to me to have been entirely within the control of Ericsson. Ericsson decided not to charge 50 cents to Intel for licensing. It said, we know Intel is making the chips that embody the patents. We're perfectly happy with that. Why is that not an implied license that would generate an exhaustion defense?
Your Honor, I know
that issue isn't here, but I began thinking about how to figure out what can be considered in constructing the royalty.
Your Honor, I'd say two things. One fact that was in the record is that as a conscious matter, Ericsson did not sue licenses from the people who made the Wi-Fi chips that embody the entire patented features and many more. Now, the question of did that impliedly result in exhaustion was not litigated, and I don't honestly, it's not before the court. if there was a covenant not to sue or a license before to Intel, there would be an exhaustion issue.
I'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal, but I do have one more question. The royalty stacking, this, that you referred to the Judge Robart's trial, in that case there actually was evidence relating to royalty stacking. The testimony that you all proffered was extraordinarily weak on this point. It was, well, we assume there might be some stacking. This is number one, and then there might be others stacked on top. There was no actual testimony. It was surprisingly weak. So, I mean, every judge has to look at the record that's actually submitted in front of them. Judge Robart had a materially different record than did Judge Davis. So why should someone instruct on a point that the evidence doesn't raise?
Well, Your Honor, let me just focus on the Ericsson portfolio and give you the evidence that was in the record. Mr. Bones says Ericsson has 18 patents declared essential. 7 patents were sued on. 5 were litigated. Only 3 were found infringed. If it's going to be 5 cents a unit for everybody who holds 18 patents, this case is a multi-billion dollar case. It's the reason there's much interest on both sides for the amici. That is what's important, and that's why the fact, to go back to the patents, the fact that these are declared essential doesn't mean anything about whether they're essential. And think about what happened in this case. 7 patents sued on, 5 litigated, 3, and we contend that all 3 are not infringed. And you're going to allow a nickel a patent for what literally is thousands of patents? This has, to get back to where we started,
again,
it has...
Again, this is
all
a theoretical argument, but there was not actually any testimony that talked about the fact that anyone had ever, with respect to stacking, that there had been any other license that was demanded.
Two different points, Your Honor.
Yes or no? Tell me yes or no. Is that
no, Your Honor, because we have the evidence of 18 declared essential, Ericsson seeking a license. There, Ms. Peterson got on the stand and said, we go after the end users. We don't go after the chip manufacturers. And we've gone after them on this basis, and we go after them to get our...
Okay, but your argument is the judge should have said that other people could come in and stack, and there is no evidence that anyone else has ever done that, right?
No,
I... We have to actually look at the evidence that's in the record.
Your Honor, the evidence in the record, just looking at Ericsson alone, shows the problem of stacking. And all that we asked for was an instruction that said the people engaged in the hypothetical negotiation would have considered the fact that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of patents that have been declared essential by someone or relate when they're determining a royalty. There is record in the evidence that shows that the end result of this is that the royalty would be 50 to 100 times more than the cost of the chip. That's in the record.
Okay.
And I'm well into my rebuttal.
We'll give you 4 minutes for rebuttal. We'll give another 5 minutes to the opposing counsel. Okay.
May it please the court. There obviously are many issues involved in this appeal, and we thank the court for your gracious extension of the time in this argument. It's my current intention to cover the points that we've just heard argument about, since the court has expressed interest in those matters, and of course if there are others that have not been discussed and the court has questions, I'd be pleased to address those.
Okay.
So shall we start with the most recent thing that we heard about, damages and royalty stacking?
I want to talk about the 215.
Then let's talk about the 215.
Your proposal of the claim construction, which the district court adopted, included a reference to feedback response message. How does that get into the claim construction if the preamble is not limited? Without the preamble, this second data unit or whatever it is could be anything in the world. Yet you say it's in fact a feedback response message. How does that not come from the preamble, in which case the whole preamble is limiting, including its minimizing the response message?
Well, the preamble does use the expression feedback response, and the court's construction does refer to a feedback response, but I don't think that it's necessarily a principle of claim construction that the court is not allowed to use language of all kinds in the claim construction as long as it's supported by the specification. So
right,
the mere fact that the court chose...
How is this claim even understandable without treating the preamble, which is the sole reference to the feedback response message, as limited? And if part of it comes in, why not the whole thing?
From the specification. I don't think that... I don't, with respect, agree with Your Honor's supposition there, or Your Honor's the basis for that argument, that merely because the court uses the phrase feedback response, that it's a necessary implication that the court treated the preamble as a limitation. In fact, the parties, the defendants, didn't contend that the preamble was a limitation.
Can I ask you a question on that, too?
Of course.
I'm not going to go through it at length, but hopefully you listened to my question to your colleague. And this technology is hard. So given my interpretation of what 215 does and your colleague's response that if that's the interpretation, it's covered by the prior art and that it just can't be that, what's your response to that?
That there is not a static type identifier field here because there are three choices in the standard that the designer of the system can use. The minimization element is found in the preamble, but as we've just discussed, there is no suggestion here that the preamble is...
So you're suggesting that the difference is that the standard allows choices, but my understanding is all the chips, they don't allow choices. They come with one response.
Once designed, correct.
Right.
But the designer of that chip has available in the standard the ability to minimize the feedback response.
Okay, but the accused product is the chip. It's not the standard.
No, it's not. But nothing in the claim requires that the chip make the choice in order to minimize anything.
Didn't you say exactly the opposite of that in so many words, saying the invention is, you know the quote, because it was
repeated throughout the brief. But there is a choice. The choice is made by the designer of the system who chooses to implement what that designer believes is the most efficient feedback response for minimizing overhead. And that choice was made, compressed block acknowledgement. But there is no language in the claim
what you said was that the receiver has a choice, not the designer.
Well, I can only say that read in that context, that language is inartful because it is crystal clear from everything that happened in this case and every bit of the appeal that the receiver is not what makes the choice. That's not in the claim. What the claim says is that they're responsive to the receiving step. There is constructing a message field. And then it explains that one of the contents of that message field is to include a type identifier field. There's nothing whatsoever in the asserted claim that indicates that the receiver makes any choice at all. And Chief Judge Davis so found in his judgment when he said the claim construction only says that it must identify, not that it makes a choice about different types of feedback. There is a choice in the standard.
Can I ask a question again? Because I don't understand your answer. Does the prior art cover a receiver that receives message and then responsive to the receiving step constructs a message field with these various steps with a pre-programmed type identifier field? Is that covered by the prior art?
No.
Okay. And why not?
Because the field in this situation is not static because there is a choice to use
more than one. This is the leap I'm not getting. It is static for the devices because it's pre-programmed.
Once the choice is made, it's static.
So if we agree, I'm a little unclear. Do you think choice is critical to your patent over the prior art? the notion of
response
being
not being static is critical, and the ability of the designer to choose something other than a static choice is critical.
But if we disagree with you that it's the designer's choice that's relevant, it's the receiver's choice that's relevant, then this isn't infringed. Because the receiver here is not making a choice.
I agree. If the court concludes that the receiver must make a choice, this patent's not infringed.
Okay.
But to elaborate on that just a bit, a careful reading of Claim 1 shows that that can't be the case. Claim 1 requires something happen responsive to the receiving step. What is it that happens? Well, it goes on to explain what happens is constructing a message field.
Right.
What are the characteristics?
Look, here, I understand all that argument. It's confusing to me why you're agreeing that choice is in here, because I don't see choice in any of the stuff below the preamble, and I'm not sure I even read the preamble as including choice. If we were looking at that interpretation of this language, it seems to me like you have a pretty strong argument. But once you concede that somehow choice is important to the claimed invention, whether it's with regard to the prior art or not, then I have a hard time seeing where they infringe.
Well, choice is important if the preamble is treated as a limitation. Now, we don't agree that it should be. The defendants haven't really contended that it should be. But if minimize is imported as a limitation into the claims via the preamble, then there has been minimization here because the designer chose the type of feedback that it believed minimized overhead. In response to Your Honor's question in the previous argument, first of all, as I hope that I've explained, we don't believe that the preamble is a limitation and that minimization should be imported. However, under the circuit's precedent, even if the court determines that the preamble is limiting and that minimization is a part of the claim, if the evidence of record shows that that new element is met, this court may affirm the finding of infringement. And we believe, as we've explained, the fact that there has been a choice, the fact that the designer of these systems has been able to achieve minimization through the selection, in this case of compressed block acknowledgement, satisfies that limitation, even if it's to be imported by this court.
When did you first give the defendants notice that you viewed the technology in all three of the patents now at issue as essential to the standard?
I don't honestly remember that date, Your Honor, because, of course, there are a number of different defendants, and all of those communications happened in separately. There is a stipulation of evidence in the record that sets forth the notice that was given, the claims that were made, and I believe it includes, for all of the defendants, the accusation that the technology is essential to the standard.
But at some point during the case, you made that clear, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay,
that we believe that these three patents are essential to the standard?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
You didn't ask the judge to make a separate determination as to essentiality. You both argued that to the jury?
Yes.
Okay. Answer me some questions about the 568. It says that it identifies a type of payload. I'm having a hard time understanding how a loose correlation with identifying payload can be enough.
Okay. With respect, Your Honor, there isn't a loose correlation. It's an occasional correlation, and let me explain what's going on here and the confusion in the briefing created by the quotation of some of our expert witnesses' statements that the system doesn't really know what the payload is based on the traffic identifier. The standard requires, in Table 9.1 of the specification, a traffic identifier 0 to 7. That is not optional. It must be included in every packet. Every transmitter must include that traffic identifier, 0 through 7, and every receiver must check and receive that.
All right, that's a traffic identifier.
It is, Your Honor. It is,
Your Honor. Payload identifier.
That same section of the standard, in what it describes as informative, not required, associates traffic identifiers with the content of the payload, data, video, or voice. Some applications choose to use that association. For example, some applications do not. For example, if we're talking about an application that's email, it's only carrying data, that application may really not care about prioritizing the packets because a brief delay in the transmission of that kind of data isn't important. It may choose the designer or the author of those applications running on the defendant's products may choose not to use that association. However, other applications do find it important, such as Skype, a video conference call over a computer. There, it's very disruptive to the call if there's any delay in the transmission of voice, and somewhat disruptive if there's a delay in the transmission of video. Those applications may choose to use the association and to associate the traffic identifier 0 through 7 as suggested in the specification.
Was there, other than that they may choose, was there actual evidence of choosing?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That came from our expert witness who performed testing on at least 4 separate programs: C-SIP Simple, Skype, Akiga, and Q-Wave. He testified that he tested those systems and that those applications chose to use the functionality of associating the traffic identifier with the content of the payload.
Right, but he didn't, and I gather, tell me if this is wrong, couldn't have testified that by looking at the identifier, one could tell what the payload is.
Looking at the identifier alone.
Anybody can use it. And that's what, isn't that what it means to be an identifier that identifies the payload?
No.
By looking at the identifier, you can tell what the payload is?
No, Your Honor, not in this context. What he testified was, if you simply put a device, a sniffer, in the midst of the data transmission, and you don't know whether the applications on either end have chosen to use this feature, then you can't be sure that the traffic identifier, which you will see, is or isn't being used to identify the content of the payload. But the applications know that. If you're sending a Skype call, the transmitter and the receiver know that the type identifier is being used to identify the content of the payload. An observer simply looking at a transmission without knowing whether it's coming from Skype or an email program or something entirely different has no way of knowing that choice that is being made by the applications. But the important point here is that at all times, these accused products are capable of carrying out that functionality, and because they are reasonably capable, the apparatus is infringing.
Can I just ask you, do you happen to have available the specific citation for your expert saying not only that these applications happen to use particular 1 through 7 type identifiers for particular types, but that the applications are programmed to recognize the type by virtue of the type identifier?
I believe that, Your Honor, is contained within A1395-96. Now, I wasn't reading that section of the record with the precise answer to that question, it's in the record, but I believe that's where.
Do we really need to get into this whole discussion of capability claim limitations if, in fact, we have, as you say, evidence of it actually occurring?
No.
All right. Assuming we were going to look at this capability concept, what is it that distinguishes a capability claim from a non-capability claim? Just the use of the word for?
The drafting of the claim. In this case, a processor for arranging information. therefore a system in which the processor is instituted for arranging information and to do the matters set forth in the rest of the claim. Under the FinJAN case, that is a claim drawn to capability.
Okay.
I agree with Your Honor. This is really a belt and suspenders argument. Since there is proof that the accused products, depending on the choices of the application, actually perform as the claim describes, you don't really need to get into the capability issue, but the accused devices would be infringing because they are reasonably capable, even if there were no proof that that's actually used in that way.
Okay. Can we shift to the damages question? All right. Let me ask you about that entire market value question.
Yes.
First, putting aside whether I think there were proper objections that were made to counsel comments, I mean, it does seem a little inconsistent for you to argue to the trial court in connection with the Daubert motion that we're not implicating the entire market value rule here. We're not arguing that. We're not arguing for a base that implicates the entire market value rule, and then repeatedly refer to the $1,000 cost of laptops.
Your Honor, with respect, I would respectfully take issue with the word repeatedly. I think that it was said twice. And second, that reaches one of the two dangers that this court has articulated or presented by failure to adhere to the entire market value rule. The first danger being the danger of capturing unpatented features. The second danger being what the Unilock case described as the $19 billion cat that could not be put back in the bag. The comparison of the total overall revenues of the accused product with a presumably modest royalty rate. And in that case, the court found that comparison, which happened to be $19 billion in overall revenues, was prejudicial and could not be cured by argument or cross-examination.
So your view is that if you're only talking $1,000, it doesn't make a difference?
My view is, first of all, the context of those remarks, every time they were made, if Your Honor reviews the record, were not, please, ladies and gentlemen, understand we're only asking for a little money compared to $1,000. That wasn't the purpose of those remarks in context. The purpose was to explain to the jury how the per-unit royalty Ericsson requested worked, that it did not vary depending on the price of the accused product. And the statement to illustrate that was, it's the same 50 cents whether the accused product is a $100 router or a $1,000 laptop. In that context, there was no efforts in those statements to encourage the jury to view the royalty as de minimis compared to the overall product income of the accused products. In fact, there is no evidence in the case in which the jury was ever informed of the amount of overall accused product revenues.
All right. With respect to the entire market value rule jury instruction, I understand that you think the entire market value rule wasn't implicated, but what would have been the harm of allowing a jury instruction just explaining how it works, so that to the extent that there might have been confusion based on your expert's reliance on those other licenses, that confusion would have been, you know, obviated?
Your Honor, in all candor, if the standard in this proceeding today was, what would have been the harm with giving some additional jury instructions? I'd have a really hard time in telling this court that under some circumstances, some judge might not decide to do that, and it might be proper. But, of course, that's not the standard of the issue that's before the court today. The issue is, did Chief Judge Davis commit reversible error, harmful error, by refusing to give the additional instructions that the defendants requested? I think that the answer to that is clear from a review of the instructions that he gave. In this context, I think that it's very important to put this issue of the FRAND obligations and how they relate to traditional jury instructions into a historical context.
I'm sorry, are we shifting from end product value to standardization value, that is from hold up to from tire market value to friend, et cetera. Before we do that, can I ask you the same question about exhaustion that I asked,
yes,
asked Mr. Lee? Why is it that when you knowingly allowed Intel to make chips practicing your patent, that's not an implied license that exhausted your patent interests in those chips?
All I can say in response to that, Your Honor, is that that's an interesting question. I have never heard of any precedent for the proposition that a party's forbearance from suing a defendant who may be infringing constitutes a covenant not to sue or an implied license. Judge Davis, Chief Judge Davis, in his judgment, specifically considered this issue in the face of Intel's complaint, not dealing with exhaustion, but complaint that Ericsson allegedly would not license Intel and would not negotiate with Intel. And in finding that that was not true, Judge Davis said that he was aware of no authority and the defendants had presented no authority that any party was obligated to sue an infringer or obligated to seek damage from them once they intervened. So my answer, Your Honor, is I don't think that it would be an implied license. I think that it takes far more under any authority I'm familiar with to create an implied license than simply a party saying, we're not going to sue chip makers, we're going to sue end product makers.
All right, with respect to the RAND issues, the defendants refused to agree or be bound by a RAND determination by the trial court judge. Did you agree to be bound by a RAND determination at
yes,
the trial
Your Honor.
Court? Okay. All right, so you have to go to the jury, and you have to go to the jury on all the issues, right?
Well, the parties agreed to submit the contract, defendant's contract claim on the alleged Ericsson's alleged breach of its RAND obligations to the court.
Right. Okay.
That was tried to the court. Chief Judge Davis found that Ericsson had not violated its RAND obligations and that the defendants had failed to negotiate in good faith.
It might have made for a more informed jury if all of that went to the jury, but I can't second-guess counsel stipulations if they are what they are.
But, yes, Your Honor.
But with respect to the RAND issues then, clearly both sides had an opportunity to raise any arguments that they wanted to raise to the jury. Were there any restrictions that the judge put on either party with respect to the RAND arguments that they could make or
not
the evidence all. They could present?
Not at all, Your Honor, and those arguments were made. The defendants argued that there was a danger of holdup here because the value of the patents was attributable to adoption in the standard and not the value of the technology. The defendants in the evidence, as well as in argument, said to the jury, I can't recall the exact number, but I think it is that they posited you might have $30 or $40 in royalties on a $2.50 chip. That was argued and presented in the evidence.
When the defendants made the argument that standardization value had to be subtracted out, did you say, oh, no, it doesn't have to be, or... It was.
No, we did not. What we said was.
So how is it, if you didn't, how is it that this seemingly fundamental piece of law, actually, if it's the correct rule, cannot be told to the jury with the authority of the law rather than letting the parties fight about whether technological value has to be distinguished from standardization value?
Well, again, with respect, Your Honor, the issue before us today is not whether or not the jury can be informed of that. The issue is, was it reversible error
I understand.
To
that's
inform
the question.
The jury?
I'm sorry. Maybe there were too many negatives. How is it possible to leave to the parties and the jury the argument and decision about whether standardization value has to be excluded?
Because it's accommodated in the Georgia-Pacific factors and the instructions that the judge did give to the jury.
Where do you think it's accommodated in the Georgia-Pacific factors?
Hold up, Your Honor. What we're talking about here is the value of standardization and the alleged ability of the patent holder to charge supra-competitive royalties.
Well, it's not necessarily even hold up. It's that there's a trade-off because the patent holder gets an increase, presumably, in market. And so as a result, that could skew what would appear to be the normal value.
But, Your Honor, put your finger on a very important point. The principal value delivered by standardization is an increase in the number of infringing products.
Can you point me in the jury instructions where a reasonable juror could figure out all this? I looked at them. I mean, this stuff is hard for me. I don't understand reading that jury instruction that it would tell me at all to exclude the value of the standardization.
It wouldn't do so in those terms, but Judge Davis did take pains under Georgia-Pacific Factor 15 to instruct the jury that you have to consider the position of a willing licensor and a willing licensee, as the judge observed.
How would a juror know that that doesn't allow them to negotiate and include the after-standardization value? You agree that it's error to allow them to include the value from the standardization.
In the rate,
right.
Not in the base.
Okay, but even in the... That's fine. I don't think that's an important distinction for purposes
of
the jury instruction.
The rate must be attributable to the value of the invention. The base may be greatly increased due to the value of the fact that it was standardized.
Sure.
In this case, Erickson presented evidence of a number of license agreements negotiated at arm's length between
the parties. Can I just get you back to the jury instructions? Because this is really what I'm asking about.
Yes.
Where in the jury instructions specifically do you think that a juror would have understood them to direct them to exclude the standardization value?
Georgia-Pacific factor number 9, and I'm sorry, I don't have a reference to where that appeared in the court's jury instructions, but he gave all of the Georgia-Pacific factors.
And I honestly don't have those committed to memory.
Okay, well.
But this, I assume it doesn't say anything about excluding standardization.
He did not. Let me be clear. Chief Judge Davis did not, using the terms either hold up or exclude from your considerations, an increase in rate due to standardization. He did not use those words. But if I may retreat back to the point that I was making 5 minutes ago, this issue about patent damages in the context of standardization is not new. There have been nationwide standard-setting organizations up and running and in business since 1901. Standard-setting bodies had been active for 70 years since the Georgia-Pacific factors were first enunciated, and throughout the 32-year history of this circuit, standard bodies have been incorporating patents into technological standards. This is not a new issue. As long ago as 2000...
It is a new issue in this court, isn't it? I mean, there's no case in which a party has said when the patent is covered by a standard that the jury instructions need to tell the jury that the economists, the experts, actually do need to find the best means possible, reasonable means, of segregating the value that comes from the fact that everybody kind of has to use it from the value representing the technological improvement over alternatives.
I'm aware of no case that's ever said
that. So it really is, in terms of a legal issue, it's a fresh issue.
I can't agree, Your Honor, because the Georgia-Pacific factors have been used for decades, including in the context of standards.
Well, maybe just because someone didn't think to raise the issue before doesn't mean that it's not something we should address. I mean, there are lots of things that parties finally figured out after years of trying cases, perhaps improperly.
I would never be so bold as to suggest this court not address anything that it considers appropriate. But I do disagree with the presupposition that this is something new. This is something that technology has driven us to, and that the courts must respond in a new way to account for these issues. These issues have been around for decades, and this circuit has a long history of precedent in instructing juries about reasonable damages. The instructions that Chief Judge Davis gave were consistent with that precedent and accomplished the goals of standard setting in that they protected the patent holder, the innovator, by providing a reasonable royalty, and protected the alleged infringer and the public by making sure that that royalty was reasonable and under the proof in this case had gone through the acid test of actual lengthy negotiation by specific negotiators who would have been entirely capable of saying, wait a minute, Erickson, we're not going to pay you these tens of millions of dollars because what you're asking us for is attributable to adoption in the standard.
Well, isn't Georgia-Pacific factor number 5 misleading in this context? The one that talks about the commercial relationship between the parties?
I don't see why. It doesn't mandate any particular conclusion as a result of the admonition to consider the relationship.
And the licenses that your expert relied on, at least half, as I understand it, were actually negotiated after the final version of the standard.
That's correct.
Issue, and I don't know when the others were, whether they were at a
some
time.
Some before and some after.
And even the earlier ones were at a time when people knew that this was going to be the in the standard, because
yes.
It takes a long time. Right. So, and your expert didn't make any effort to say when the parties sort of sat down and negotiated, of course, at that point, they know what they have to do. They can't negotiate about, well, we'll walk away from the table if you're charging us more than we think the technological improvement over some different type identifier would be. They have to do it.
Well, they have to do it if they want to practice the standard. I agree with that. But they don't have to agree to anything that Erickson asks. And there is no evidence, there's evidence in this case that Erickson, in the course of negotiating its license agreements, never heard a complaint about holdup from the licensees, and no evidence to the contrary.
Right, but I mean, that may just be an artifact of the fact that holdup is a kind of politicized, soundbitey term that conveys a lot of this is really stinky. Message, right? But
yes,
just the question.
That's a good quote.
Right. Well, and that's why people choose terms, right?
Yes, Your Honor,
so, but the question: what is the technological value attributable? The value attributable to the technological improvement is not the question that negotiators in this business of making products would be asking themselves and saying at the time that this is already in the standard. They're trying to figure out what do we need to pay to stay in business to make a product compliant with the standard.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The negotiators would and did say, why does this 215 patent contribute any value to us? Can we save money? Is it more efficient? What's the metric at which we're going to arrive at a dollar value that we're actually going to pay for? What they did not do was to go through the exercise that Your Honor is positing, which is to say, well, it's in the standard now, so we've either got to pay everything Erickson asks without negotiation, or we've got to reach into the air and say, well, this is the additional standardization value. How does anyone know that? What they know are the hard facts of the negotiation. True, the licensee may be very motivated to enter into a license agreement if it's in the standard and they want to practice the standard.
Right, but what that suggests to me is that real-world licenses negotiated in the shadow of the standard may not, in fact, be terribly informative about the proper 284 royalty value.
Well, Your Honor, what I would say in response to that is, of all the decision makers available to us here, the jury, the trial court, and this honorable court, and negotiators at Hewlett-Packard, who do we believe is most capable of isolating the value of these inventions to Hewlett-Packard?
Anything else? All right. Mr. Lee, shortchanged you, and I'm going to blame it on you, because when you got to the yellow light and you said, I'm in my rebuttal, you actually weren't already in your rebuttal because we started at a different time. All the courtroom clerks do it differently, and I did not understand that. So you actually have a total of 9 minutes left. So you can because I shortchanged, you had 4 minutes left on your 30 when I cut you off, but I gave them an extra 5, so now you've got 9. If you give any of that to Dell, which you can, I do, in fairness, have to let them respond for an equal amount of time.
Your Honor, I'll accept responsibility for it. I'll take the 9 minutes. And,
all right. But I apologize.
And it may have been my fault, too.
It wasn't really your fault. I just needed somebody to blame. So.
In exchange for 5 minutes, I'll accept the blame.
Okay.
Let me make 5 points. First, go to Judge Hughes' question, the 215 patent. Let me read you a quote. And this is repeated by counsel in their pretrial statement, in their briefs, by their expert, by the inventor. And the quote is, of the 215, the invention is, as expressed in the claims, giving the receiver a choice. And that's at A6478. It's at A6473. It's at A6474. It's at A6477. It actually is in the Markman opinion, Your Honor, at A8 note 2, where the district court described Erickson's point, which is Erickson contends the invention is the creation of choice at the receiver. And they said it in the pretrial brief and in the evidence. And that is the key, because as Mr. Cawley said, if the receiver must make a choice, there's no infringement. And we believe that the intrinsic evidence established that the receiver must make the choice and there is no infringement. Let me go to the 568 patent, which I didn't address at the outset, but Mr. Cawley did, and make these points. Judge O'Malley, there is no proof that any of these applications actually operated in accordance with the claim.
Didn't their expert actually do the testing, the analysis?
Yeah, and what he did, Your Honor, is the 2 pages that I cited to you described in general what they did at A1395-96, mm-hmm. but at A1647, he actually tells you what it shows. And his analysis for Akedia, which is the program, the application program that he put on top of the system, was that for TID value 0, it was video, but that doesn't correspond. But for TID value 5, it was video, it did correspond. It was a complete coincidence. The claim limitation requires that the TID actually identify the type of data. At the Markman hearing, Erickson contended that all you had to do was identify the characteristics, and Judge Davis rejected that because the type of data, the specific type of data, was important for 2 reasons. One is that's how they distinguished the prior art, and at A18 and 19, Judge Davis says explicitly that. The second reason is this. If you read Claim 1, the transmitter is identifying this type of data, and the specification makes clear the whole purpose of this is so then it gets transmitted to a receiver, the receiver knows what type of data it is, and then it can do something with it based upon the type of data. At A1406, their expert concedes what is exactly the same thing we said, which is you look at the TID value, you cannot tell what kind of data it is. It may be, it may not be. It's like the analogy we use, it's a broken clock that twice a day may coincidentally have the correct time.
But did their expert testify, and I didn't, at least on quick rereading, did not see it at 1395-96, that in the particular applications, whose names I don't remember, that he said he tested, that the application reads the TID number as an identifier of payload because that's what it chooses to do?
I think that's why what he says at A1647 is so key, because this is where he says exactly what is true, which is there may be a coincidence, but there's no identification. There's not even a correspondence. And, Your Honor, this is because if you read the claim, the transmitter is identifying this information for a reason. And the specification makes clear that the receiver then uses it. In our system, the TID does not identify the payload information. We don't need it. And at the receiver, Your Honor, the receiver never says, what type of payload information do you have? Because it's not relevant to 802.11n. So again, this is one claim limitation the service pipe identifier, and literally one fan.
Tell me exactly where you are at A1647. What page, what line?
At A16, can I get the copy?
Mm-hmm.
So if I start, Your Honor, actually at A1647, and I start you at page 33 in line 19,
okay,
and you continue down to page 34, line 21. And Your Honor may recall that in the informative designations in the standard table 9.1, 5 is video, but 0 is not. And when he did the experiment, by coincidence, one of them, 1.5, turned up video, but 1.0, which in the standard is not video, did not. That's because it is like the broken clock. And the analogy to the broken clock, it's as if the claim read, a clock which identifies the correct time. This never identifies the payload information. It's because we don't need it. And, Your Honor, that's why...
I mean, even a blind squirrel gets a nut now and again. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, basically, Your Honor. And, you know, actually, with the broken clock, the only way you know that, coincidentally, it's actually right twice a day is if you actually have a clock that works. And we don't identify the type of payload information. Dr. Nettles, at 1406, and I don't think it was as equivocal as, I have great respect for Mr. Pauly, but it's not as equivocal as he said. He was asked point blank, if you look at the TID value, can you tell what the payload information is? And he says, no, you can't. And I think to go to Judge Toronto's question, there's a difference between saying a conclusion, which is the TID equals the service type identifier. The underlying fact is not in dispute. It's no identification. Third point, to go to the damages issues.
Before you get there, can I ask you a question? What if we were to agree with you on some of the infringement arguments, but not others? So in other words, we'd say, you're right, one patent, there's no infringement, but say, as the other two, there is. Putting aside all the other issues you have with respect to damages, does that impact the damages calculation, the number of patents infringed?
It would, Your Honor. I mean, I think the best way for me to answer is this. I think that if you considered the three and the possibilities are 0, 1, 2, 3, but if it's some mix, some infringed, some not, then the court would have to reach both the entire market value damages and the RAND instructions in order to guide the determination next time around. And that actually leads to my next point. The RAND issue is a new issue. The number of amicus briefs you've seen, it's not because the patent issues are complicated, as the judge you said, and they're interesting, but we're here because of the RAND and entire market value issues. And all of the amicus briefs are about this. Judge Holderman and Judge Robards, I think, issued really scholarly opinions because it's a new issue.
Okay, can I ask, in those cases, were those contract claims for violating a RAND commitment, or were those patent claims in which RAND was discussed as relevant to the interpretation and application of 284?
A little bit of both. Microsoft was a contract claim, and Avashi was a little bit of both. Judge O'Malley's right in terms of the manner in which things were determined. But to go to Judge Hughes' question and Judge O'Malley's,
I like being right, so just let me ask you one
thing. Sure.
Am I right that if the contract question had been tried to the jury at the same time you were discussing the damages on the infringement, there would have been no question about how fully informed the jury was about the whole grant process? Right?
There would have been a different answer to your question. And one of the things I did want to mention, to be more precise, the question you asked about were the stacking and all the patents before the jury, the answer is yes. It came in during our damages expert's testimony. It's at A1608. And beyond the 18 Ericsson patents I mentioned, literally 977 were part of that. But to skip back, if I could, just to the RAND issue very quickly, Factor 5 and Factor 9, which I think Judge Mr. Colley mentioned Factor 9 to you, Your Honor, you mentioned Factor 5, they are actually a great example of why Georgia-Pacific doesn't work. Factor 9 is the utility and advantages of the patent invention over older models. I mean, the utility and advantage of the patent and invention is more valuable than pre-standardization because of standardization. And you'll see, we propose specifically what I would call a Judge Robart's addition to that instruction. And on factor five, Your Honor, we ask that the instruction be that this occurs in the context of RAM. And I think that is different than the normal hypothetical negotiation.
What more should the jury have been told besides the instruction, that the two references that the trial court gave them?
Your Honor, I think, and we made specific proposals there, we added, to go to Judge Toronto's question, we added the portion that says, for each of the factors where it would apply, you should consider this factor in light of the technical contribution of the patent invention, not its value after. And then on
that was your addition on 9 6641.
Yes. And then our addition,
which is not dependent on RAND.
It's not dependent on RAND. And I think the fact that there's RAND helps, but it's not dependent upon RAND. The stacking is more dependent upon RAND. And we ask that the jury be instructed that in the hypothetical negotiation, the licensor and licensee would consider the fact that there's 1,000 other patents out there.
Right, but as to stacking, I mean, certainly there were lots of arguments that you all made that there were all these other patents out there and they had to take that into consideration. But I think the one thing that Mr. Crawley kept coming back to, which is true, is that the question is, in light of at least the limited record that you put on with respect to stacking, is it really prejudicial error in this case? We're not going to sit down and say every jury instruction has to look exactly the same. That's part of the problem with Georgia-Pacific. Everybody thinks they have to recite it over and over. We've said you don't have to, but they keep doing it.
And, Your Honor, the answer is that I don't think we're asking to articulate a precise formulation for all, but what we're saying is Georgia-Pacific, which is now 50 years old, isn't sufficient to instruct the jury on the question, for instance, of people sitting down when they know that there's 977 other patents out there. It's a hard concept for lawyers. It's a really difficult concept for jurors. And then if you actually compare what we asked for on these two issues, the value of post, rather than use hold up, I'll call it the value post incorporation and stacking, and then compare it to the other Georgia-Pacific factors where someone has thought that legally we need to give the jury some guidance, these are actually more important in this context. Very last point is this. On the entire market value rule, we thought, Your Honor, we had accurately stated the objection at 1437 to 1438 in our footnote. But let me say this. The entire market value, it's not just the billion-dollar number. It's an analytical framework, where the court has held two very simple propositions. If you're going to rely upon the total revenues of the product, then you must show that the patent features drive demand. We both agree that there's no evidence here that these three patents drive demand for the products. So the second principle is, have you apportioned? And they have not. And
the judge actually concluded that there was at least apportionment or recognition of the need for apportionment in the expert's testimony. So the question is, did you ever ask for a limiting instruction at the time of Mr. Boone's testimony to have the jury told that don't be confused by the fact that these licenses are being introduced because the royalty base can't be based on the total value of the product?
Yeah, two answers, Your Honor. One is, at 18, this is the continuing objection, and here's what we said. There's a first objection to the licenses. Then they say, we are also about to commence testimony about the calculations for royalty rates from these, the license agreements. And they're based on the price of the products in total and percentage royalty. We object.
But did you ever, that didn't answer my question. Did you ask for a limiting instruction?
I wasn't trial counsel. I can't recall as we stand here, but we'll check.
I think probably not.
I don't recall, is the honest answer.
And you're, as I read your brief, I know we're going way over here, but as I read your brief, you say that the trial court could have fixed this problem with that one jury instruction that you proposed?
It would be an instruction, but then we could have made the argument based upon the entire market value rule. And I think, Your Honor, this is the end of the answer to your question, and the last point to make is the apportionment that's required. The first principle is, if you're going to invoke the entire market value, show that your patented feature drives demand. If you can't do that, and there's no disagreement here that you can't do that, you have to apportion something. But the apportionment is the value of the patented feature to the royalty base you're using. What they did is they apportioned licenses between 802.11 and 802.11n, and then they used an agreement that they had with a licensing broker to try to assign some value to 802.11n. It had nothing to do with apportioning based upon the value. The instruction, you are correct, the instruction
right,
okay, that we asked
for.
Here's
my last question. I'm sorry. I keep going back to all these thoughts I've had. But interestingly, Judge Holderman allowed in all these licenses that were based on the total end product, but then ultimately concluded that they weren't very informative. Isn't it just as likely that that's exactly what the jury did here, because those licenses ranged from anywhere from 50 cents to $1.50. The plaintiff's expert asked for 30 cents, and the jury came back at 15, which isn't really far off the ranges that either Holderman or Judge Robarts came up with. So I guess what I'm saying is, why can't the jury do exactly what a judge is capable of doing, which is to understand that those licenses are arguably relevant, but ultimately not that meaningful in the calculation?
Your Honor, three quick answers, since now I'm for sure over time, and it's these. One is, those licenses were not, by definition, comparable. That's the Daubert motion. And here's the reason why. The one license that was discussed was the HP license. Tens of thousands of patents. The only allocation that was made by lawyers after the litigation started. That's not what the court was talking to Unilock and Microsoft. Second point is, what this court said is the licenses, and Judge Holderman said, the licenses need to be technologically and economically comparable. And he then determined that they were not. With a jury, there is a gatekeeping function for the court to perform. And the third, I think, is the most important, is at the end of the day, what the courts, and this is not as new, it's new in the last 5 or 6 years, what Lucent, Microsoft, Laser Dynamics said is, as an economic and legal matter, give the jury some basis to apportion the value of the patented features to whatever you claim the royalty base is. Mr. Bone's analysis, which is all based upon allocating licensed patents, didn't do that. Thank you.
Okay. Case will be submitted.
All right. Now the court is adjourned for tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock a.m.